Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, listeners. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm glad you could join me for another live broadcast of The Heretics 2 Hours. It's October 24th, and I have a pleasant topic tonight, painting and music in the Third Reich, and two excellent guests to help me discuss it. They are Dr. Wilhelm Christman, a World War II vet from the Bay Area, California, and Rodney Martin, who is in Southern California. The arts were vital and vibrant during the National Socialist period in Germany, not least because Adolf Hitler was himself an artist. I don't mean only that he was a talented sketcher and painter who planned to make his living doing this, but that his sense of art and love of art imbued his entire personality. And he was sensitive and receptive to beauty in all areas of his life, and he very much enjoyed the company of other artists. I will remind you that you can call in during the second hour. The toll-free number is on the Voice of Reason homepage, and I will also announce it when the time comes. I'll go now to my guests. First, Wilhelm Christman, who is returning to the Heretics Hour after too long of an absence. Hello and welcome, Wilhelm.
Well, good evening, Carolyn. Nice to have me at the show, and very nice to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. So good to hear you. I'm going to drop the designation of doctor for you, if that's all right with you, because we're good friends, really, and it's kind of silly to keep that up.
Well, that's about highly time, I guess.
All right, and a big welcome also to another Heretics Hour regular, and that's Rodney Martin. Hi, Rodney.
Hi, Carolyn.
Rodney, hiya to you. Nice to hear you for the first time and hope we keep in touch.
Yeah, same here. I'm very honored to share the program with Wilhelm.
Well, I always am too. He's a very special guy. And we're gonna express that a little bit more as we go on. But I both of you here. And there's so much to say that we're never going to get it all in. But to keep some order among the three of us, and also to be fair, I'm going to ask you both to make whatever opening remarks you feel appropriate, since I already made some. We'll start with you, Wilhelm. So please give the listeners, if you would, a brief introduction to your firsthand experience with tonight's topic.
Well, I think I should start with the time when I was transferred to Berlin in December 1940 and stayed there from 1940 December all the way through March 1942, flying first at an airfield in southern part of Berlin, Rangsdorf, for the anti-aircraft defense organization there, and the second half in the western part of Berlin in Döberitz, an airfield which was adjoining the former Olympic Village, and flying for the staff of Colonel General Weisse, the supreme commander of all the ground defense for Germany, Holland, and Denmark. And at that time, whenever I was not busy flying and off duty, I was exposed to the very vivid cultural life at that time in Berlin. Really amazing and unbelievable, the variety. And whenever I had time off, I had access to excellent tickets. All kind of cultural activities, the opera house, the philharmonic, the Staatstheater, die Schillertheater, die Deutsche Opernhaus, Musicals, Kabarets, Sportevents. In one word, I mean, a bouquet of cultural events, which was amazed to have it available 1 year. War was already. And that impression is still very strong with me today because, quite frankly, some of the operas which I saw at that time, I never saw again. Mm. And this, I think, is a privilege. And this is when maybe we were talking about that our show, I can make some contribution.
Yes, thank you. We're going to be, I'm going to be focusing on painting in the first half of this show, first half hour, and then we're going to go on into more into the music in the second, but you can contribute in both, I know. So you are a real art lover. You've always been an art lover. But let's let Rodney make a few comments now. Do you want to make some remarks, Rodney?
Yeah, let me make just a couple of opening comments, Carolyn, that way we can get right into the program. In my last appearance, we talked about culture, and in that program, I received an enormous amount of emails, and please, folks, keep those coming. But and I contrasted in my last appearance what had happened under the Weimar, the 20 years preceding the National Socialist government in Weimar, and how culture was so it was so degenerate and how it had to be cleaned up and purified under the National Socialism. And I wanted to just share a quote as my opening statement. It's very brief. And let me just, you know, if anyone seeks verification as to the absolute corruption and the degeneracy of corruption under Weimar, this quote from the Jewish musical author Eric Levy, this is a quote from one of his books, and this is him speaking. The Weimar Republic still remains one of the most stimulating periods of 20th century music history. Now that says all, and we'll, as we get into the program, I'll give you some examples as to why Mr. Levy would make such a statement. Because we'll see that music, for instance, which we'll talk about tonight, was under Weimar was dominated by international and Jewish influences, and was that all was essentially cleaned up under the National Socialist government.
I certainly agree with that. Thanks, Rodney. All right, I'm going to start out with the painting because that's my special field. And I have very much the same to say about that. So I will make some comments here, and then I'll ask the two of you to join in and say whatever you want to say about it. I'm going to go on a little while here. be patient. The political consensus about the Third Reich and art, its attitude toward art, as we all know, is that the National Socialists were ignorant ideologues who persecuted and or drove out all of the talented true artists from Germany because they worshipped second and third rate, kitschy, mundane, lifelike works of art. This was the National Socialists. This is more the case about painting, actually, than any other branch of art, such as sculpture, architecture, or music. They really kind of take on the National Socialists for their attitudes about the painters more than any other, I think. That's my opinion. But like everything else that's said about Hitler and his associates, this is false. I'm going to give my version of what happened to painting and painters under National Socialism and then ask my guests to give their views. Now, the battle revolved around modernism in painting. Modernism was revolution in the entire culture and a leftish Jewish revolution that got unleashed like so many other revolutionary ideas out of the First World War. Modernism was universalist, not nationalist. It rejected the notion that art should reflect a nation, its history, and people. It actually did. Modern artists felt no national sympathies or loyalties to a nation or race. They rejected out of hand the status quo. We're used to art being this way now. We think that this is perfectly normal, that artists should be outsiders who really rather despise and reject ordinary people and live in their own elite type of environment. But, and remember, we are because modernism triumphed And you know, it has been the unquestioned doctrine of art as long as any of us listening, any of you listening to me, have been around, including me, but maybe not Wilhelm. Now, not surprisingly, many modernists were Jewish modern. They were Jewish modernists by their, well, modernism was Jewish, basically. Modernism, by its own admission, celebrates disorder. By its own admission now, let me tell you, celebrates disorder and uncertainty. It brags that the gap that opened between modern art and the public was not the fault of the artist, but the fault of the public. The bourgeoisie had no aesthetic sense, just as much as it was the fault of reactionary governments such as National Socialism. They rejected any obligation to society or to inculcate national pride, providing beauty, joy, and a refuge from life's travails. Artistic freedom was absolute. Contrarily, Hitler preferred the straightforward realism that had prevailed in 19th century German painting. Some of the greatest German painting ever was 19th century German painting. Although they are not the most famous, they are earlier painters, but like Dürer and Holbein and so on. But this 19th century German painting was certainly outstanding. And Hitler didn't think that ugliness could be considered art. He didn't accept that simply playing with colors or reaching back in time to primitive styles or portraying obscenities could be art. He didn't think art should be shocking, abstract, pessimistic, distorted, cynical, disorderly, or freakish, all qualities that modern artists not only accepted but embraced. And he said, here's a quote, "To be German means to be clear." And he wanted and supported a German art for the German Volk. Now, this taste in art didn't begin with Hitler, actually. In 1901, Kaiser Wilhelm II declared in words very similar to what to Hitler's words that I just quoted. He said, "Art, which merely portrays misery, is a sin against the German people." And he also said the word liberty is often misused and can lead to license and presumption. So some of these art styles that that were rejected by National Socialist Germany were Dadaism, Cubism, and Expressionism. And the paintings were banned from being exhibited in national museums and government-sponsored exhibitions after 1933. And in fact, the degenerate art exhibition didn't take place until 1937. And it took a while, as all these things did, for the for them to finally try to actually get rid of these influences. Many of the painters actually they just left Germany, and the National Socialists considered it good riddance. Although the international art world, which embraced them in other places, remained Jewish, and the Third Reich art policies were fiercely condemned everywhere. And this is the consensus beliefs that we are left with today. So let's go back to Wilhelm. You know, I know that you're an art lover. You were then and you are now. But you told me you remember your visit to the House of German Art in Munich in 1941 and again in 1942. So why don't you give us your firsthand experience and remembrance of that as a citizen of the German Reich, which you were at the time?
Well, that was Eastern or Pentecost 1941, and then later on 1942, when I was in Ansbach with the training unit, I had a chance to visit Munich and visited there the Deutsche Museum and the Pinakothek, and then also Haus der Deutschen Kunst, where they had the permanent art exhibition, which I think started 1937, the House of the Deutsche Kunst was built by, I think, Professor Trost. He died very early. His wife took over. And it had a large collection of present German art. I remember vividly the art of Junghans, Padua, and Leibl, because Junghans was pretty similar to what our Austrian Waldmüller produced and painted half a century earlier, kind of realistic romanticism landscapes, still life, life of the common people in the fields, in the villages. Padua was more an act painter, and labeled also landscaping. And then all in over, the impression was it is a strong revival of natural realism and romantic naturalism, like Marquardt, which I think Adolf Hitler liked very much, and again, Waldmüller. Mm-hmm. Close to or next to the Haus der Deutschen Kunst was then in another building, probably a former museum, the Entartete Kunst, the Artet art, which was a collection of, I think, close to 200, maybe a little bit more, of Dadaist and Surrealist. Amongst them, I remember it was one of our Austrian surrealist, Oskar Kokoschka, and then Paul Klee and Max Ernst. And I think it was also one or two Chacals. And then some artwork from sculptures. And in the Haus der Deutschen Kunst, in the German version, there was also sculptures from Brecker and Kolbe.
So they had this art mixed together in this one particular museum. No, I realized.
No, it was a separate. The Haus der Deutschen Kunst was a very big building in the neoclassic with Greek type Corinthian columns and the Entartete, the art art was exhibited in next door, separate building.
Yeah, and why did they exhibit this work that they disapproved of, that you were just mentioning, Paul Klee, Chagall, Kandinsky?
Well, it was surrealist. I mean, there was a turbulent non-figural productions.
But I mean, was it labeled as degenerate art? This was already in 1941 and 1942. Was it labeled that, or was it just there like the other art, you know, all in a separate wing?
Obviously, it was confiscated artwork, which was taken from different proprietors, and just as a contrast to the German influence, the German, typical German art, exhibited there to show how terrible and how unpleasant the whole images were.
Yes. All right. So they had it there as a contrast, and it, you know, with the idea that this was not good art, but. Probably a lot of people still liked it or liked some of it. I imagine you liked some of it. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I mean, you know, it's
I think later on, I mean, I never knew at that time about Chagall, but well after I arrived here in the United States, I visited an exhibit of Chagall in San Francisco. And, I attributed it to a kind of, farmer's art or children art or primitive art. And some of them, all the flying angels and the flying persons over his hometown, Vitebsk, looked a little bit, truthist, but,
Well, all of this art is not terrible. Some of it is pretty decadent looking, but it's not all real terrible. But the point is, it is not, according to the German thinking at the time, it was not uplifting to the German people. And in fact, it introduced a rather destructive state of mind, which didn't help the Germans to understand their own identity. And so, in a sense, art was put at the service to an extent, of the people, but, you know, artists were free. All the artists were free to do as they wished.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Carolyn, may I make just a quick comment? I believe there is a difference. The exhibit that Wilhelm is speaking about, that was a distinctly different exhibit in 1941, 42 of the art that was gathered up from the nations that had been occupied by the Wehrmacht, as opposed to the degenerate art exhibit. That was done in 37, and there was again done in 38. So the degenerate art exhibit, which was done, clearly showed the public, the German public, what degenerate art was and its corrosive influences on the national community. And the national community was a distinctive term that meant something. But the exhibit, I believe, that Wilhelm's talking about that was adjacent to the House of German Art was an art exhibit of, you know, art that had been, and Wilhelm, correct me if I'm not mistaken, was art that had been picked up in France and Belgium, and was the contrast French art, Belgian art, maybe art from, it had been picked up in the Ukraine and Russia, and I didn't know they actually did art in the East. But anyway, and contrasted it with German art.
Okay,
it was not the same. Yeah.
That makes sense. And you know, these artists, Kandinsky, Chagall, Paul Klee, they're not the worst ones, you know.
They
weren't considered that. All right.
If you watched and looked at the painting, for instance, of Kokoschka and Kandinsky, Kandinsky, you just couldn't make out what's going on there. I mean, it's a mixture of colors, geometric figures, supposed to be a human body, and the eyes on the on top, the head on the bottom, and I could see the people looking at it. They said, "Well, what's going on here?" And I learned now it's degenerated art, not de-arted art. Thanks, Rodney.
Yes, well, some of the degenerate art exhibit in 37 included Otto Dix, Max Beckmann.
Well, Kokoschka
was in there.
quite a few of these art pieces were exported to Switzerland and sold at an auction, I guess. Either, I don't know which town in Switzerland, but with very much of, and the rest, quite a few, I think, were just destroyed.
I don't know what they destroyed. I have never been able to find out too much about that. They say they destroyed some of it. They had tons of it stashed away, you know, in closets and stuff, because there was an awful lot of it. But I don't know. I don't know what it was destroyed. But let me just make some comments for the listeners here. That official Deutsche Kunst, which Deutsch art, German art work at that time was considered naturalistic. It favored traditional values. It was folkish. It represented the German people in their daily lives, so they could relate to it. And landscape painting. Some of the major themes were landscape painting, which brings up the idea of soil, and that was very, very important to the Volkisch idea. And another was animal paintings. There were not that many, but there was one of the great animal painters with Julius Paul Junghans.
I remember that. The horses and cows.
Yes, his horses, wonderful. And they were working, you know, like working horses, pulling plows and stuff like that, or pulling wagons, and they're just really wonderful paintings. And then another theme, of course, was the family. That was a major theme. We have a lot of famous paintings from that time. The one is by Adolf Wissel, called Farm Family from Kahlenberg, 1939. But another was the German woman, and the mission of the woman was to be beautiful and to bring children into the world, mainly. And they did nudes, and they did women with children, with their nurturing their children, and there were a lot of paintings of old women too. So
quite a few paintings too, innocent, beautiful bodies and idealistic And romantic to a certain extent.
Yes, was, yes.
So I remember one of my home country's artists, former Benedictine Patres, Sweetbird Lovisa, one of the best known woodcutters. I mean, he had his prints there exhibited, and it was really home art, more or less, in the life of the farms and the valleys and the mountains in Kenton.
That was really encouraged. Crafts work and home, what you called home art, you know, people doing their own simple art and so on, folk art. That was very highly encouraged. And one of the famous nude paintings is The Four Elements by Adolf Ziegler. I know you're familiar with that. That's the one that was hanging in the over the fireplace in the Fuhrer building in Munich. And I believe Adolf Hitler purchased that. Oops, here we are already. Well, right, we will be back and finish up a few words about the art and move on to the music. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, Libya's turning a new page in its history following the killing of ousted dictator Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. His burial has been delayed after the UN called for an investigation into how he died. Gaddafi was reportedly shot in a crossfire during an assault in his hometown of Sirte. But the footage of his lifeless and broken body was so graphic, some are wondering why it was broadcast for the public to see. RT's Ivor Bennett takes a look.
This frenzied mob is about as far as it gets from a trial at The Hague. But the death of Gaddafi is now being cheered around the world.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Even by those who champion democratic justice.
People in Britain, salute your courage. And while we are proud of the role that we played to help, we know this was your revolution from your bravery. You showed the world you would get rid of a dictator and you would choose freedom.
A long way from Cameron's insistence that Gaddafi be put on trial. NTC fighters were even dissuaded from their shoot to kill policy, agreeing in August they'll take him alive.
I don't think he'd have got a particularly fair trial in any case. But I mean, nevertheless, a kind of summary execution, or what may well have been a summary execution, is a kind of fairly barbaric end to what I believe was a very barbaric operation from the start. And as I say, you know, this was never supposed to be about regime change, this NATO operation, but that's really what's been the outcome of it.
The backslapping's been fueled by this. Gruesome footage of Gaddafi's body splashed across headlines.
Completely different world, and the people power is not going to be put back here in Libya thanks to the US and its NATO allies.
This video shows Gaddafi was still alive when captured, but clearly that didn't last long. Some suggest an execution and question why this is now being applauded.
He was assassinated after he was caught wounded. This is a very heinous crime against a wounded man, and the Arab public will see it as such. I've talked to people who dislike Gaddafi, who dislike the way he was killed. They think this tells you something about the morality of the so-called revolutionaries.
This view is also shared by many on Twitter. There are several posts here already concerned about the coverage, questioning the need for such graphic images, and why Gaddafi's death, dictator or not, is being reported with such jubilation. The images have been labelled horrific. This tweet says the BBC wouldn't have used the images for anyone else. Another suggests channels are having a competition. Sally Burko, a prominent activist in the UK, says she sees why the same wasn't done for Bin Laden. Back then, Obama refused to release the images. saying it could.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn, and my guests tonight are Wilhelm Christman and Rodney Martin. And when we left for the break, I was just in the middle of talking. I have a few more things I will say about the subject matter that's most popular in National Socialist painting. And I was talking about the German woman and nudes, and I was mentioning this painting, The Four Elements, which was over the fireplace in the Führer building in Munich. And it was painted by Adolf Ziegler, and he also painted The Judgment of Paris, which that was in 1939. And there was another artist, Ivo Saliger, who painted Diana's Rest in 1940. And there are many others, but these are very well-known paintings of female nudes. And then, as I said, the other female subject was the mother. And there are also female portraits of famous actresses and wives of party leaders. That was popular. And they were mostly demure and ladylike. And I will say that the National Socialist periods that made painted and powdered faces frowned upon, and they wanted healthy sports were encouraged for women. And the German man, of course, was the big subject. He was shown as a worker, a hunter, a farmer, and of course a soldier. And during the war, more and more paintings of soldiers and war scenes were painted, because that's what the people thought they wanted to paint or should be painting. And then, of course, there are many portraits of Hitler as the Führer, and he did not request these, but all these German people who were devoted toward him, they were painting portraits of him, and they would show up in these exhibitions. That there's a big exhibition held yearly, in this exhibition, the works were for sale, and it was encouraged that the people buy them. And in order to encourage that, Hitler himself bought more than anybody else. He bought a lot every year. So he had a huge collection of art. But this is all I can touch on for the moment. I want to move on to music, and I'd like to ask Rodney to start that out.
Hi, Carolyn. Well, as with art, and I'm going to contrast this, as I did in my last appearance, with what was going on with Weimar, because it's important to understand that, Weimar was a Jewish Marxist creation, and Weimar was, and I can't stress this enough, was the prototype to what the Marxists and Jewry had in mind for other nations and what has actually happened in the United States. But in the music world, in Germany from, 1919, after with the foundation of the Weimar Republic into the early 20s, they sensed this early on. And, of course, and during that time, the National Socialists were not even a major political power yet. And so, some traditional German composers did begin to speak out, and there were others such as Max von Schelling and Walter Hausen. All but ceased their work during the Weimar period. Richard Strauss continued to compose, but really didn't speak out. He eventually became the president of the Reich Chamber of Music under the Third Reich, but he was clearly opposed to the Weimar decadence. Hans Pfitzner openly and vocally challenged, and this was in the early 1920 to 1921, again, at a time prior to the NSDAP being a political force and not even being well known outside of Munich. And Fitzner said, made this statement, you know, nationally, the German culture and music was under threat from modernism and international Jewish influences and fragmentation and pernicious influences of international Jewry. He made that statement in 1920 and 1921. So there was a deep recognition in the music, within the German music, and intellectuals within the German music community, that there was something desperately wrong and that the Weimar Republic was just loaded with decadence. And to fill that out, if you look at it, and I researched and found developed a graph of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and the number of 20th century composers performed from 1919 to 1944, because there wasn't any performances after 44 because of the bombing. During the early years of Weimar, 1919 to 1925, it was a vast majority of the composers were non-German. It was completely lopsided. Only in 1925, during the Weimar period, Carolyn, was there a majority of German composers. And that happened to be during the election of President von Hindenburg, who was staunchly conservative. Then again, as it drifts from 1926 to 1932, it drifted back to about 60 to 65% of the time it was non-German composers. Then during the period of the Third Reich from 33 to 44, it was a majority German most of the time, with the exception of 1939 when it was about 50-50. Getting back overall, the National Socialists, in particular, Hitler's call for a restoration of German art and culture, that struck a very sympathetic chord with traditional German artisans and musicians. And I got to stress traditional. In Mein Kampf, Hitler had denounced what he called the Bolshevization of art and culture and stated that it was the duty of the government to save its people from being stampeded into intellectual madness. Now, this made a lot of sense to musical intellectuals. It really did, who had been fighting, you know, this issue back in the early, from 1919 and early 1920s. And it made a lot of allies, you know, this is what brought Winfried Wagner and publisher J.F. Lehmann and composer Friedrich Klose into the ranks of National Socialism.
Yes, there were an awful lot of artists that were quite happy to be National Socialists and to support, you know, to be participating. Do you have any comment on that, Wilhelm?
Well, what I really would like to mention is what happened in Berlin at that time as far as music events are concerned, because there was a lot of variety. Operas in the Staatsoper and in the Deutsche Opernhaus, concerts at the Philharmonic, musical at the Admiralspalast and the Metropol, solo concerts in there, primarily where German and Italian operas, some, I think, Peer Gynt, a Norwegian Greek opera was played, but...
it's my understanding that French opera was not too popular, or French... I just have here French opera, not too popular under National Socialism.
I do not remember any French operas. It was all the classical operas from Germany, in Wagner. I remember attending the Lohengrin, Tannhäuser, the Flying Dutchman,
Renzi,
then some of Mozart operas, naturally, then Karl Maria Weber, the Freischütz, Lortzing, the Waffenschmidt, I think Smetana, the Czech, the Verkaufte Braut. And then a lot of Italian operas, and there were even guest singers. I mean, Beniamino Gigli sang in Berlin several times, performed, and he was supposed to be the 20th century Caruso. Then we had, I remember, Helge Rosvenge from Denmark was performing too. And on the musicals, my goodness, you had Johannes Heesters from playing in the metropole and the operetta from Strauss, The Merry Widow, and Benjamin Gigli, I mentioned. There were musicals in the Admiralspalast and in the Metropole, and then soloists, Backhaus, I remember, on the piano artist, Enrico Menardi from Italy on the cello. Oh, cool.
You have an amazing memory.
Amazing.
For all of this.
Amazing variety of operas and operettas and also cabaret. I mean, the comedian and kind of merry-go-round pieces. I mean, and
well, there was a great deal of freedom. I mean, these composers, they weren't dictated to. But if they were out of step, then I guess, what would you say, Rodney, if they were out of step with the thinking, they weren't given as many opportunities? Would that be the way it was?
Well, I think, actually, Carolyn, and let me make an editorial comment. It's one thing, you know, for someone like, you know, to go out and it is hard work to research and find facts, but to have a tremendous asset in Wilhelm here who actually lived there and who was a witness to the truth is something that is absolutely essential, and we really need to hear more from Wilhelm and witnesses like Wilhelm to tell, you know, and get the truth out as to what life was really like. Because when the more people learn as to what life was really like, the more they're going to see through the lies and the distortion and the false propaganda. But getting back to your question, Carolyn, as we saw what was happening, under what we would call the Wilhelm era, you know, prior to what we call the Second Reich, you didn't have this degenerate and foreign influence type art. Then all of a sudden in Weimar, there was a complete switch. You had the foreign influenced art, the degeneracy, you know, the things that we were so shocked about in the 1980s and 90s, the Robert Mapplethorpe crucifixes and bottles of urine. That was going on in Weimar. That was going on in
it
Weimar.
It was.
And people
yes.
didn't really realize it. Yes,
yeah.
That type of art was going on.
Yeah, so Dadaism artisans, and all of that.
Yeah, you know.
The artisans were, the traditional, the real artisans were thrilled after April. And I'm using the case of April of 1933 when the Civil Service Reform Act, Restoration Act was established, that enabled the government to remove tenured civil servant artisans and musicians from the state payroll and replace them with artisans that would comply with wholesome standards instead of pseudo-pornography.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think there was any, sure there was guidelines, but, but any moral society and civil society, there has to be guidelines. The flip side of that is anarchy, and as Wilhelm knows, he was there. That's what the Weimar Republic was. You had anarchy on the streets, you had anarchy in the government, and you had anarchy in the culture.
Well, I think music was very deeply rooted in the German people, in Austria and in Germany, from youth on. I mean, singing and playing music. I mean, already in the Hitler Youth, I mean, we were singing in the army. We were singing. There were songwriters very popular. I remember Hans Baumann and Menzel, and you couldn't. There were days. What is originated the day of house music, trying to cultivate. Playing in the family, within the family. And I remember in my home province, Carinthia, in 1938, we had a so-called a choir of young people, of Hitler Youth, which were singing folk songs, but also art songs. And without singing, a life was not possible, I think.
Well, I'm so impressed when I read that here now and then I come across it that yes, these marching troops during the war, they would be going here, there, wherever, and they were singing. You know, that was tough. I mean, I suppose when things were really hard, they weren't singing, but you know, they it was in the tradition to always be singing. Mm-hmm.
There was. I had in my private collection a Wehrmacht songbook, a songbook. It was a songbook that was standard issue to the Wehrmacht. I'm sure the Luftwaffe had their own. And then for Wilhelm's benefits, I'll have to make arrangements to show him sometime. I have an original 1940 exhibit catalog for the House of German Art. And, you know, they issued one every year right up until 1944. And I have an original exhibit catalog announcing the new additions to the permanent exhibit of the House of German Art in Munich for 1940.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
There was in Berlin from, I think, from 1940 on, every week a concert on Wunschkonzert, you know?
He wanted to ask you about that last time. Rodney did.
By request.
Yeah. Wunschkonzert.
Concert by request. And it was in the Funkhaus in the Masuren. I attended it once or twice, and it was just a wonderful, big orchestra. And then all were soloists, and one of them, I remember, Strings. He was singing, there was a kind of a Didi song about Churchill, and they called him the Lying Lord, and that was a very popular song. You know, there were some singers like Maria Cevetari. She was a super alt and opera singer at the Berlin Opera House. Diana Lemnitz, remember then Marika Röck, the Hungarian. She was a paprika, exciting woman singing.
As an American, I'm speaking for myself, okay? I don't think Americans can appreciate what it is like, what it is to be a part of a nation, say like Germany, where you still have a very strong sense of your roots and your and belonging to this nation, because we're such a different kind of a country in the United States of America. We don't have that kind of I don't know. I'm at a loss. I'm not coming up with the right word.
Kind of modern music too. I remember Karl Orff with his Carmina Burana. That was a medieval nuns and patres song. I mean, very exciting, very staccato. And then there was another one. I mean, religious requiems by Reger and. I think Pfitzner, his Palestrina oratorium. There was such a variety of productions, cultural life.
It was a very fruitful time in especially in music and sculpture. My gosh, and architecture too. Can you comment on Wagner and Bruckner? A little bit. Why was Wagner so important? Why did Hitler like him so much? And why is he so important to German music and German culture?
Well, I think it was primarily his Ring, which revived the old Nordic saga of the Nibelungen. That's how I think it was every year. I think up to about 1942 at the Bayreuth festivals. And it was a typical, origin of the Teutonic sagas and the poetic way of expressing it by music. And it was Wagner's music, I think, was highly dramatic, but on the other side was a narrative. And I think this is why Hitler liked Wagner, he liked Bruckner, which was a very heavy, heavy tool. And he appreciated also one of the younger composers, Eck. I forgot his first name, but I think he was composing the Olympic hymn for the Olympic Games in 1936.
Oh, I don't have his name down. Eck.
It's E.G.K. I forgot his first name, but he was a very independent, very proud, very sophisticated composer.
And, well, what about Wagner's anti-Semitism? What do you think that stems from?
It was very strong and pronounced and was continued by his wife Winifred Wagner and made him a lot of enemies too. Some people.
Well, yes, but now Wagner was like the National Socialists, although he was much ahead, before them. He was very very pro German, very Germanic in his thinking, very nationalistic, I suppose, and that would be why he thought the Jews were a problem for Germany. What would you say, Rodney?
I would say that Wagner's anti-Semitism was no greater and was a reflection of the times and of what was happening and the actions of world Jewry at the time. Mm-hmm. What had happened. There was a stranglehold put on. I mean, look what happened just recently. I have issues with, the demands and such of the protesters that are at Occupy Wall Street presently. But one lone lady held up a sign calling out the Jewish bankers, and she was fired from her job as a teacher. Mm-hmm. She told the truth about the Jewish control of the finance system, and she was terminated from her job. So I would say, and that's a kind of a roundabout way of comparison, but I would talk about Wagner's anti-Semitism. Bear in mind, anti-Semitism was not invented by the National Socialists. It had been around years and years before. It was prevalent, in Vienna of all places when Adolf Hitler was a young person. Going to Wagner operas with August Kubitschek. So I don't think that his is Wagner should be singled out as the champion anti-Semite. There was certainly a lot of anti-Semitism was a prevalent philosophy that was a direct response to a rather engaged cabal at the time, and a cabal that is still very strong.
Well, I guess, go ahead.
Okay, we're made to believe, Carolyn, that there was this huge purge of Jews, from German cultural life, and as a result, there was no real art and culture and music in Germany in the period of 1933 and 45. And actually, the opposite is true. There was a tremendous cultural rebirth, and I used that term before, and I can't say it enough, in Germany. Germany was the only country in Europe between 1933 and 45 to commission and construct new museums on the scale of the House of German Art, and to invest tremendously in the arts, including music. Now, we talked about previously in the previous show that there was chambers. There was the chamber of film. There was a chamber of theater. There was a chamber of writing. There was a chamber of press, advisory and supervisorial boards that oversaw. And they could actually censor or expel an artisan or a writer or such. Now, bear in mind, between the Third Reich period, Germany's population was roughly 60 million. In the film world, as I've been asked this question previously, there were only 750 expulsions between 1933 and 1945, a 12-year period out of a 60 million populace. In theater, there was only 535 expulsions. In writing, there was 1,303. In the press, 420 in the press. In music had the highest number of expulsions, 2,310, and in art, 1,657. It had to do with guidelines and such that actually were embraced by the vast majority of the German populace, and I dare say the vast majority of true German artisans. The ones that didn't want to comply were the degenerate ones that just up and left because they attached their artisan position to a tenured state position. And when the Civil Service Restoration Act was passed in April of 1933 and they lost their tenured position, i.e. they had to They lost their political safety net under Weimar. They all just left because they would not comply and could not comply with the standards of the national community.
And I think that Hitler was very involved in the music world. He was really quite a music lover and quite knowledgeable. I have written that he saw the Wagner operas over and over again. He saw 100 times. He saw 100 performances of Wagner's famous, not one of the Ring ones, but that one that's probably, some people say it's his best one. What is that one, Wilhelm? The Meistersinger, is it?
Well, yeah. I think one of the most important men organizing the cultural life was Dr. Joseph Goebbels. He was the head of the Reichskulturkammer. He was the minister of Volksaufklärung und Propaganda. And he also insisted on this Reichskulturkammer sits.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, we will be back in 5 minutes, and it will be our call-in time, but we will also continue with what Wilhelm was saying.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Simon Marks with the latest world news. The US is accusing Syria of malicious and deceitful propaganda against its ambassador to Damascus. Robert Ford has now been withdrawn from the Syrian capital for consultations with the Obama administration. In a retaliatory move, the Syrian government has ordered its envoy to Washington to return home, leaving neither country represented in each other's capitals at ambassadorial level. The Obama administration says the Syrians put Ambassador Ford's personal safety at risk by publicly accusing him of running death squads in the country. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland.
We want to have a chance to talk to him directly about the situation. We also want to give a guy who works in very intense circumstances a little bit of a break, a little bit of a rest. But also we have this concern about the direct targeting of him personally in a very malicious way on the state media.
It's not clear when or if the two ambassadors will return to their respective posts. Hopes are fading in Turkey as the search for survivors continues following the weekend earthquake that left at least 265 people dead. The head of the International Relations Department for the Turkish Red Crescent Society, Kaan Saner, says that alongside rescue efforts, providing shelter from the elements is now a key priority.
The temperature was of great concern because the average temperature is 13 degrees Celsius in the daytime and minus 3 or 2 degrees Celsius in the nighttime.
The whistleblowing website WikiLeaks is suspending publication operations to focus on fundraising amid what it claims is a financial blockade. The site's founder, Julian Assange, says US-based finance companies are throttling WikiLeaks' ability to function.
This financial blockade is an existential threat to WikiLeaks. If the blockade is not torn down by the end of the year, the organization cannot continue in its work.
But Luke Harding, author of a book on WikiLeaks and a reporter at the Guardian newspaper, says there was more to the announcement than just the financial squeeze.
It's basically one guy, Julian Assange, and he's brilliant, but he's very kind of self-consumed. And this is the problem. I mean, the organization is, I think, rather, you know, slowly starting to disintegrate.
In other news, Libya appears to be preparing to bury slain dictator Muammar Gaddafi. His body has now been taken off public display in the city of Misrata. And moderate Islamists have claimed victory in the elections in Tunisia, the first nation to undergo a revolution within the Arab Spring. Official results have yet to be announced, but polling station data suggests that the Ennahda party will come in first place. This is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We have completed our first hour, and now we're starting in our second hour. My guests tonight are Wilhelm Christman and Rodney Martin, and our topic is painting and music in the Third Reich. Let me remind you that you can call in now. The number is 1-855-477-2283, and we'd be happy to take your calls, and you can ask whatever you want of whoever you want. Now, let's continue. Wilhelm was talking about Joseph Goebbels, and he certainly is an important figure in the arts in the Third Reich, and I'm glad that you brought that up, Wilhelm. So you were saying you were just kind of got started to speak about him.
Well, right away after the Machtübernahme 1933, Goebbels originated the Reichskulturkammer, not the culture chamber of the Reich. And then this was kind of the head organization. And then they formed five or six different chambers for the literature, for the theater, for film, for music, for the performing art, and for the press. And that included all the artists in the different fields. And the Goebbels minister were kind of overlooking the whole production, the whole affairs, the whole box.
Okay, continue.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, don't read the messages. Just go ahead, Wilhelm.
Okay, well, I was mentioning the five or six different chambers of covering the different fields of art, literature, film, music, and performing arts. And there were... all those artists were members of the Deutsche Arbeitsfront, DAF, which was taking over the former trade unions, and Dr. Ley was in charge of the DAF, and they were strongly supported by the government. It was, I think, also a semi-official organization, and spread all over Germany and in major cities like Berlin, Königsberg, Dresden, Breslau, Hamburg, Köln, Munich, and Vienna. They had all their cultural life in the theater, in the music hall, in the philharmonics, and in the comedian theaters.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. And so, were there Were there ever any disagreements between Hitler and Goebbels over the arts? I think they were only just very minor little artistic disagreements, not anything else. And Goebbels always pretty much went along with
Hitler. Not so much between Goebbels and Hitler as between Rosenberg and Hitler, and to a certain extent also the Minister of Education, Rus. But there was not much interference of Hitler in Hartberg, I think.
Yeah. Let me give out the phone number again. Call-in number is 1-855-477-2283. Rodney, what do you have to say about Goebbels?
I think he was clearly a genius, and Wilhelm was that. Of course, I don't need to say Wilhelm was correct. Of course, he was correct. He was there, but there was tremendous friction all the way up to the end of the Third Reich between Goebbels and Rosenberg over the cultural various cultural.
Oh, those
affairs.
Two, yes.
Yes, uh-huh. There always was. But I think it's important to know too, the German music and the arts. You covered this in your portion, but music particularly as well. Took a dual approach in the Third Reich between 33 and 39, just before the war. And those two approaches were preservation of German purity and upholding trends against modernism. And then, of course, when the war came along in September of 39 and on, there was a whole different advent of war art and music, which was very distinct. And that could be a whole show in and of itself. Germany's war art and music was far superior to all the other nations. I mean, there could be, there's been separate books and such written on that, and, there's a whole different, lines of art and music, and I can't say enough about that. But let me just pause and contrast to give Weimar art and music to that of National Socialist. Weimar was clearly, like today's Germany, this is the comparison I wanted to make, internationalist and influenced. I recently, in preparation for this show, I went online and found and did a search of as many German in today's, what I would call the new Weimar Republic in Germany's radio stations mm-hmm. for music. And I went on to get their broadcasting to see how many of them actually webcast their online, their regular programming. A vast majority of the ones that I can find, and I found hundreds and hundreds, was clearly foreign-influenced, mainly American and Turkish-influenced. I could find only a handful of stations in today's Weimar Germany that actually play the traditional German music, and even that, you can tell it's very, they're being very, very, very politically correct, and that's very sad because Germany has a rich musical tradition. And National Socialist German art music, as with the arts, was clearly folkish, clearly traditional, and centered on the national community. And
they had symphony and philharmonic orchestras in every major city. There was, for instance, Furtwängler in Berlin, our Austrian Karl Böhm with the Staatskapelle in Dresden, the Gewandhausorchester in Leipzig, in Munich down there, Clemens Krauss and Eugen Jochum. And then even they had foreign conductors, a very exciting young conductor, Celi Bidace, Romanian, in Berlin. And then the young Herbert von Karajan, he was just announced and got the job of a general music director in Aachen and was then invited to Berlin with his first concert in the Philharmonic. So it was really something outstanding in every major city. And the same thing with the radio orchestras and the so-called Reichsender Symphony Orchestras.
Well, even in cities that weren't major cities, didn't they have a lot of cultural activities? They had something going on
can I
in moderate cities.
Orchestras,
Yeah.
You know, there were, you know, the major orchestra, of course, Berlin was the, you know, was the creme de la creme. And, of course, my understanding is, and is that Dresden was probably closest to the Berlin in terms of quality and depth. And, of course, it was the Leipzig Orchestra, Hamburg, and Munich. And then after the Anschluss, you know, Vienna. But there was also the National Socialist Reich Symphony Orchestra, which was established in 1931. And it was a traveling orchestra. And you never hear much about it, but you should. It performed over 200 concerts a year. It performed also performed abroad in other countries. It performed in Italy. It performed in Hungary. It also performed at the party rallies for, you know, the political events. But it was also, and this is little known, the National Socialist Reich Party, National Reich Symphony Orchestra was the orchestra that performed at the 1936 Games in Berlin. But you never hear much about it.
I've never heard of it. I've never heard of it. So I traveled around and played in smaller cities and towns.
Yes, it did. And you covered that before, Carol, and we talked about it. You had performances in factories, but you also had performances out in the rural areas. The German populace was an extremely cultured populace. There was an extremely educated populace. Our farmers may listen to Trace Atkins and country music. The farmers, which were major supporters of National Socialism, they listened to symphony orchestras. And Wilhelm could attest to that probably is better than I can.
Well, right now we have a caller, gentlemen. So let's take our caller. See what he has to say, or she. Hello, caller. Can you identify yourself, please?
Yes, this is Hadding in Florida.
Oh, hi, Hadding.
Yeah, I have a slight objection to something that Rodney said there. He said something about the music being all folkish and so forth. Actually, I'm sure that that's what they were trying to encourage, music of a national nature, German classical music and German folk music and so forth, but the jazz and swing were not totally banned.
That's true. That is true. I haven't gotten farther along in my notes yet. I was going to cover that. I was going to cover the jazz, what was their version of swing, and some of the dance music and things like that. We just haven't gotten further enough in the program yet. But you're absolutely right.
Rodney, remember Peter Kreider? It just came to my mind. He was kind of a jazzy music here. Peter Kreider. Does it sound familiar to you?
No, I don't know. No? Myself. Rodney, are you there?
Yeah, I missed the name. I'm sorry. I was reaching down and grabbing it.
Peter Kreider or Kreider?
Kreider.
Peter Kreider.
Kreider. K-R-E-E-R. And that was kind of jazzy music.
Let me address Hadding's point because he's correct. Actually, in April of 1933, Berlin Radio announced the actual formal ban. They actually banned jazz, but it's kind of a loose ban. And then in the following year, actually, was probably just in January of 1935, Jürgen Habermaski, maybe got that last name quite pronounced correctly. He was the director of German radio. He actually would go on to be director of German television. The Third Reich developed television in 20-some-odd years. Yes, I guess. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, he actually clarified what was being banned was, quote, nigger jazz. Mm-hmm. That was the clarification statement. So there was a jazz and a swing version that was very popular amongst the German dance music, and it was even listened to at the Berghof.
Well, called it Unterhaltungsmusik. That's amusing
absolutely.
Music.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I remember dancing with my date
Benedict von
Bresky. And that was 41, and early 42.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I think the folkish part. Well, there was a lot of emphasis on folkishness, but that wasn't. There was also a lot of sophistication available. But also, like in the painting in painting, the paintings were about the people. They were about the folk. They weren't about some intellectual idea or ism or some, you know, politics that modern art is about, you know, or whatever it's about. I don't know. Breaking ground.
The art in the Third Reich was representational. They didn't just have a bunch of strange
It was representational, but the subject matter tended to be the people themselves, you know, so they were seeing themselves in all these different ways, and it was, you know, giving themselves an identity or, you know, reinforcing their identity. I think it's all very positive.
Well, I want to mention this. I got interested in this question of jazz in the Third Reich because when they dedicated that D-Day memorial on the Washington Mall, the History Channel offered a study guide for teachers, and this was carried the name of some woman, PhD historian. I think her last name was Bailey. And it contained the claim that people who listened to jazz music in the Third Reich were killed.
No.
I emailed this woman and asked her about that. She said, "Oops, that shouldn't have gotten out like that." Well, who's responsible for this, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, I, and probably one reason why Mr. Haddon, she said that is because you called her on it. Joseph Goebbels even commissioned a jazz orchestra called Charlie and His Orchestra. I have recordings that I've been able to recover. I listened to them. They were great.
Carl Schmedler, yeah.
The end of that. Yeah, and they were actually broadcast over shortwave as a propaganda tool in English into the Anglo-American lines, and there were some great, great ones. Songs, you know, they obviously were mocking Churchill as a warmonger, FDR for being a lapdog to, you know, the Jewish special interests. They were so hilarious and popular, and a lot of people don't realize this, and this actually gives, you know, credence that you're calling this lady on this. Deutsche Grammophon released a record of those Charlie and His Orchestra jazz recordings in 1943.
But, you know, the reason why Goebbels was able to put together Charlie and His Orchestra is that these jazz musicians were still performing around Germany in various bands. Die Goldene Sieben was one. I actually translated the German Wikipedia entry on Freddie Brockzieper. He was a Jewish jazz drummer that stayed in Germany until after the war. So, yeah, jazz was definitely live. But was it broadcast on domestic radio at all?
Yes.
It was?
Yes, it was. And they say Deutsche Grammophon made the recording in 1943, and Wilhelm could probably test to it. He heard what we'd call, you know, the German jazz. What was actually not broadcast is, as was said in the clarification in 34, was the degenerate, quote, nigger jazz was verboten for a whole, you know, a lot of obvious reasons, but there was jazz.
What was some of the jazz? I mean, can you name some of the jazz artists that we would be familiar with that were okayed in Germany?
Die Goldene Sieben is one.
I have some of the recordings here. I'd have to dig them out, but you know,
they were German jazz musicians. They weren't American jazz.
Okay. Some of them had, you know, there was some, you know, Freddie Brockzieper was a Jew born in Greece. His father was a German soldier. He was half German, but he was a Jew.
Okay, and, so you look up German-made jazz. Interesting.
Yeah. You look up one of them, like Die Goldene Sieben, and you'll find a bunch of others. Also, I mean, I think the music in Marika Rook's movies probably qualifies as jazz.
I looked at
a lot of the soundtracks that were in most of the UFA films were German jazz and swing.
Okay. All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Haddon. Thank you for your call. And, yes?
Well,
yes.
I want to give you another interesting statistic that people don't probably appreciate. The number of
the number of musicians actually increased in National Socialist Germany. Let me give you a comparison. The numbers I'm using are 1932 and 1935 for these categories. In 1932, there were 1,859 opera singers. By 1935, there were 2,573. In 1932, there were 2,955 chorus singers. In 1935, there were 3,422. Just musical staff in 1932, there were 546. 24 months later, 1935, there were 671. Here's the big one, orchestra, 1932, 4,800, 1935, 6,000.
Oh, my goodness.
They climbed to 6,000. Wilhelm, did you listen to music on the radio? And when you were serving in the Luftwaffe, was it how?
It was primarily the Request Wunschkonzert, which we listened to, but it was more live music and solo concerts and the Philharmonic Hall. Not so much radio music. There was one interesting, and Rodney, you probably will remember that too, the radio station Belgrade. Soldatensender Belgrade, which was a very powerful radio station, and they had cast to the Italy and all the way to Africa. And there was one famous song from Lale Anderson. Remember that song there? Porta Caserne?
What is it?
That's a song from the Soldiers radio station in Belgrade.
It's
an old, very, well, lonely song, and the Brits took it up too. And they
Lily Marlene.
Yeah, for
that. Oh, Lily Marlene. Wow, that's so good, and it's so famous.
Yeah.
For the Caserne, for the
Montreux. You're going to sing to us now. Yeah, that's a wonderful song.
Oh, that's a wonderful song. Yes. And then they had all the soldier songs on the concert by Request too. A lot of soldier choirs. Well, I think we should we covered music, we covered literature and theater, but I think one important part of Third Reich art was architecture and sculpture.
Well, it is, but we're not going to cover that tonight because I've limited it to painting and music so that we could really get into it a little bit better. So, well, we're not going to go there. We'll do that on another time.
Okay.
Yes.
Carolyn, can I give you another number? In 1940, uh-huh, there were 181 permanent orchestras employing 9,000 musicians in the German Reich. This actually, if you look at the numbers, the same demographic numbers in 1930 under Weimar, this almost tripled. This is almost a tripling of the same statistics.
Wow. Now that's a good one. Now, so you're
orchestras.
All right. So the arts. Yeah. Well, one thing about Hitler is that some people were telling him he should cut back on the arts. Because of the war, it wasn't a good idea, but he wouldn't do it because he was, as I said in the beginning, he was so much an arts person, and he thought that he didn't want the German people to go without art, and he didn't think that it was the end. He certainly hoped it wasn't the end with this war, and he didn't want them to lose touch with, you know, with all the art that they had gotten used to during the 30s under him, and he wanted to keep this art, this strong art attention going, and so he kept it going through the war. But finally, it did have to cut back. But it's a, you know, it's just a great tragedy that this was such a wonderful regime, and it's been twisted around so badly. Well, go ahead, Rodney.
It's amazing, Carolyn, from the musical approach. You know, from 1933 on, Electrola, which was a smaller subsidiary, released on average 7 new records per month. And by 1939, Gramophone, which was a larger producer, Its catalog contained, this is by 39, contained 589 patriotic marches with 8 different versions of the Horst Wessel song. Of course, all of these are illegal under the new Weimar, under the current Weimar reincarnation in Germany. And just by whistling any of them or playing them can get you 2 years in jail. In 1929, there were 40 musical publications in Germany. By 1938, there were 115.
Well, that's really a testimony.
That's the statistics there, huh?
Yeah. Fellows, I'm going to introduce something that I want us to get into in the next half hour after our break is coming up. This is not about the arts, but we have all talked about it a little bit, and it's about this new book that's come out by Kurt Bauer, in which he says that he claims that he has evidence from Goebbels' diaries that Hitler really was the mind behind the putsch, the 1934 putsch in Austria, and when Dollfuss was killed. And since Wilhelm was actually there at the time, and he knew about it, and he was living there at the time, I think it's good that we talk about this a little bit.
Interesting to discuss that and talk about it.
Yeah, I was
in Vienna, but I was out in Carinthia where there was quite a bit of activity.
That's right. So we'll do that when we get back, ladies and gentlemen. And you're still free to call at 1-855-477-2283. And we will do all that in our last half hour. Stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, the polls have closed in Tunisia's first free election. It's the first test for emerging democracies in the Arab world, and Tunisians are exercising their new rights. An estimated 90% turned up to the polls to cast their vote. The election will decide the over 200 representatives that will draft a new constitution and choose who will lead the North African country. So what does this historical event mean for the future of Tunisia? And will democratic practices echo throughout the rest of the Arab world? Meanwhile, in Libya, revolution in its earlier stages is underway after the death of longtime Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Now the interim leader says Islamic Sharia law will form the foundation of legislation in the budding government. This sparking fears that an intolerant Islamist resurgence will take hold of the country. For more on this, earlier I spoke to RT correspondent Anissa Nawi, who is on the ground in Tripoli.
These so-called liberation ceremonies haven't quite come to an end here. You can hear the fireworks behind me mixed with gunshots. So people still celebrating, and already this announcement from Mustafa Abjalil, who announced that Sharia law would be the way that Libya goes if it follows the path that he sees for it. And of course, this plays into fears that we've been hearing from analysts way before Muammar Gaddafi was killed, that the country would take a hardline Islamist direction. And this announcement, of course, just ensures that that's most likely the way the country is go if most of the members of that NCC do go ahead and get elected in these elections that were being promised over the next 8 months or so, in 8 months, I should say. And yes, there are fears here that this is going to become a very different country, that it is essentially going to become an Islamist state.
And then what about in terms of another concern is women's rights? There's some conflicting interest there with Sharia law and women's rights. What is the reaction you're seeing to that?
Well, really, Libya during Gaddafi was a relatively liberal country in terms of women's rights. Women drive here. They have a choice of whether or not to wear headscarves or so. And already today, my producer on the ground said to me, you might want to put something on your head today. People might be looking at you differently than just on Friday. And of course, he was joking, but that is really a sense of some of the fears here on the ground, that things are going to become a lot different in terms of women's rights, the way women are treated here. And that's going to be very different from the way it was while Gaddafi was still in power.
Now, Anissa, I wanted to shift our attention to Tunisia, where they just underwent their first free election. From what you know of the process there, did it go smoothly or were there any irregularities reported?
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back again, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and right now, Wilhelm Christman and Rodney Martin and I are going to discuss, talk a little bit about this latest book that has come out by a so-called historian who Wilhelm tells me is really a typesetter who kind of took up history. His name is Kurt Bauer in Germany, and they're making kind of a big deal, maybe not that big of a deal, but they're making a sort of a deal out of his hypothesis or his, what he thinks he has found enough evidence to prove that Hitler personally planned the 1934 putsch in Vienna. For those of you who don't know what that was a failed Austrian. You know, Austria didn't become a part of the German Reich until 1938. But before that, there were many National Socialists in Austria who wanted to, and they planned this coup to take over. The putsches were kind of popular back then, and take over the Austrian government under the leadership of the man named, I don't have his first name here right now, Dollfuss. And anyway, it's always been understood that they did this on their own, although people are always trying to say that the German National Socialists were directing it. So now Bauer says that in Joseph Goebbels' diary, he finds some comments that Goebbels made, and that he was at the Führer's house, and they were talking about it and so on. Just some comments like that. And he says this shows a great likelihood that this was, the whole thing was devised by Adolf Hitler personally. And, you know, as I say, they've always been trying to connect this up. Who would like to start here? I know, Rodney, you had some thoughts about this, and then, of course, Wilhelm does too. He was there. So how do we want to start this? Why don't you, Rodney, why don't you say a few things?
Let me just make an editorial comment, because I was born long after these events, but just based on, you know, my historical research and then, of course, the obvious, let's look at when this happened. This happened in 1934. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hitler had only been chancellor. He'd only been chancellor for just about a year. And if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, my chronology could be off, President Hindenburg wasn't even really dead yet. And so in 1934, the National Socialist government was still, it really wasn't even a National Socialist government in Germany. It was still a coalition government for all intents and purposes. So Adolf Hitler planning a putsch in an adjacent country, the political ramifications, you know, it's very far-fetched for a number of reasons. One, Dollfuss was a very close friend Benito Mussolini. Mussolini at that time was not an ally of Germany in 1934, nor in 1935, nor in 1936 fully yet. So it's very far-fetched to think that just a year into his appointment as chancellor, he had not yet fully solidified. There was not a full-fledged national socialist government yet in Germany. That Hitler would be turning his attention to foreign affairs. As a matter of fact, you know, Hitler's first priority was the Rhineland, getting the Rhineland fully incorporated back into the German Reich. It was not Austria. So in these comments, you know, these representations that I see some abstract comments in Joseph Goebbels' diary. Well, you know, Carolyn, I can take some comments, both orally or written, stated by somebody, and take them completely out of context, especially when the person is deceased, and say, see, there's the evidence by a third party, no less. In this case, he makes them up a third party representation, Goebbels, that, you know, that Hitler knew or planned this assassination. So it's not credible. It's just not credible. And there's been a wave recently, and I'll close, you know, on this and let, you know, Wilhelm, he was there. There's been a wave recently of going back and by these none other than Marxist or conformist historians of digging up old issues, you know, dusting them off and resubmitting them to the public as new. The Reichstag fire, you know, there was a story in Der Spiegel not too long ago about that, you know, and now this. It's all hogwash as far as I'm concerned. It was not practical to think that the new government in Germany in 1934 would be basically wanting to pull off an assassination or a coup. Sure, there was an Austrian National Socialist Party, but by all credible accounts, that was pulled off as on their own, and they're just the ramifications for the new government were just too great.
Well, you make a good point. You make a really good point about the time. I didn't think about that. Yeah, he hadn't been in that long. What do you say about that, Wilhelm? Please tell us your experience from that time.
Well, first I have to correct you. Bauer is not German, but Austrian. He's a 45-year-old Austrian who is a freelance lecturer and historian. And the book he really wrote for the Institute of Contemporary History. 1933, late, the Austrian government, which was originally a coalition government of Social Democrat and Christian Socialists, dissolved the parliament. And it became a kind of what we called at that time black dictatorship. Black because it was clerical in its structure. It was influenced by the Roman Catholic Church. The constitution was based on the encyclopedia by Pope Leo.
And, encyclical. Encyclical, yeah.
Yeah, encyclical, we call it. Encyclopedia, you know, that's in the German. I'm sorry for that. But that was also based on Roman Catholic policies and philosophy. The government at that time was headed by Chancellor Dollfuss, also a man deeply religious and clerical. He was a man of compromise. He was not a real robust dictator, but he was convinced that for Austria at that time, the government should be a kind of dictatorial Ständestaat, where no parties were allowed. All the Social Democrat Party was pretty strong, the Communists not too strong. The National Socialists was one of, there were three or four right-wing parties. All of them went more or less into underground. And early February 1944, the first revolt started by the Social Democrats.
In 1934, right?
1934, February.
Okay.
It was a bloody revolt. The Social Democrats I think it started in the city of Linz, where the police found some weapons depot and it blew it up. And Vienna was always a stronghold of the Social Democrats. And some of the city apartments were built like little fortresses. And that really the resistance and the revolt at that time lasted about over a week. The government sent out the army. They were shooting cannons towards the buildings there, and there were close to 200 people killed. Amongst them also, unfortunately, women and children. Well, that was over, and in July 1944, the revolt of
34.
So July 25th, July 34, the National Socialist Revolt started. And coming back that Hitler directed it, like Rodney really said, Hitler's attention at that time, that was just 1 year after 1933, was definitely not on Austria. I mean, being Austrian, he knew that the party is growing there and it's strong. But the man who was really responsible in organizing it was also German, Theo Habicht. He was sent to Austria in order to coordinate the different party in the different provinces. And Habicht organized the revolt. And it was not organized properly because only after in Vienna a group of police and army members, underground Nazis, were boarding a truck in the uniform of the Austrian police and stormed the chancellery where Dollfuss has gathered his government. Somehow, I think he was warned that the putsch is, something is cooking and something is going. So he released a larger part of the government, and he was only there with, Vice Chancellor Major Fey and the Minister of Defense. There was some hassle shooting. Dollfuss was heavily wounded. Not killed right away, but he was not able, probably couldn't get out, or the storming troops didn't allow it. He died at the chancellery. General Zehner, the Minister of Defense, was able to call police and army. They surrounded the whole building, and after hours, the revolting people gave up. They were imprisoned. They were put to court. They were sentenced to death. And they were hanged, 13 of them.
Yes, 13 Austrian National Socialists.
Yes. Well, in my home province, there was longer fighting. And, you know, they were supposed to, in Vienna, they were supposed to take care or occupy the radio station, and also take in arrest the president of the Republic, Miklas, so that he had the privilege to nominate the head of any government. And the former ambassador, or the Austrian ambassador in Rome, Rindelen, was supposed to take over as the new head of the government, comprised by a coalition of National Socialists and other right-wing party. Well, the whole thing collapsed. In Carinthia, they were fighting for quite a few more days, but finally the remaining militants, the militias, crossed the border into Yugoslavia, and were detained in the camp in Yugoslavia and moved then later on into Germany and returned, 4 years later, 1938.
Well, so there, I think as Rodney said, and as you said too, you know, they just keep coming up with these things. This guy's going to make a little bit of a name for himself, and he's probably got a lot of support and from those same group of people. And they just keep coming up with something to stick against Hitler and National Socialism.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the whole German leadership, which was in and was very interested, probably well, nervous too. But I mean, he had Habicht was fired. Theo Habicht, the Gauleiter of Austria, after the collapse. He more or less, well, he didn't disappear completely. He became, burgomaster of a big German city. And then, as far as I remember, he was killed in 1943 fighting in Russia. But he never again had any responsibility as far as organization of a National Socialist Party in Austria.
You know, under the National Socialists, when you screwed up, you really didn't get another chance. They didn't do anything bad to you, but you kind of didn't get another chance, I think. Well, I think we have a caller again. I think it's, Hadding has called back. Let's see if he's here. Hi, Hadding.
Yep. Hello. Yes, I just want to cut the Gordian knot on this Bauer thing about Ruthless. The Goebbels diaries that he's using as a source are fake. It's fake. We do not have the original notebooks of the Goebbels diaries. That's according to David Irving. And Mark Weber testified.
I thought David Irving is the one who said that they were authentic.
He does say that, but it's very strange.
Oh.
It's very strange that David Irving says that, because you read Irving carefully and he says we don't have the notebooks. And you read his Goebbels biography and he admits that the diary doesn't correlate to events in Goebbels' own life. I mean, it's a very strange, you know, David Irving was really stretching things to accept the Goebbels diaries as authentic. But Mark Weber. Yeah.
Would you not say that we should be suspicious of any document that was spent years in Soviet under Soviet supervision?
Well, especially since it's all typed. It's photographic plates of typed pages.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You know, that has no credibility at all.
He didn't type his diary. I didn't know that. I have not been able to really get a very good idea about what this diary is all about and what we really have, but now you're telling me more than I knew before.
Yeah,
if it's
Mark Weber
pages. Wow, that's
well, I have it in my library, but I don't know.
Most concisely, Carolyn, is that these events took place a month before Adolf Hitler was even actually the supreme, but even the president. President Hindenburg died in mid-August of 1934. These events took place in July. And at this period of time, there were only two National Socialist members in the German cabinet. And the defense minister was a loyalist to President Hindenburg, Field Marshal von Blomberg. And the vice chancellor was still von Papen, a loyalist to President von Hindenburg. So the National Socialists were not strong enough to even be considering doing something like this. And so this is very, very far-fetched, and as you know, and even if the diaries, you know, had a degree of legitimacy, the statement has been that this author, and I use that term loosely, is using inferences and is drawing his own conclusion based on statements, you know, on statements. There's nothing that's ever been conclusively said that was planned. In fact, the opposite has always been stated. So I just think it's a lot of hogwash.
Well, it is. And the this Institute of History, the Zeitgeschichte, which is situated in Munich, I think, you know, is taking it seriously. This is what's so kind of shameful in the current government.
Those are your court historians there.
Yes, yes.
But in fact, Goebbels' diaries is also the only source supporting the story that Goebbels had anything to do with Kristallnacht. That's the only source. That's why Irving used it. That's why Irving used it and wanted to say that it was credible, because he wanted to write an unflattering biography of Goebbels, and he couldn't do it without the diaries.
Well, that's what I was going to bring that up. He said, you know, I think Irving has his own purposes in so many of these things, and he certainly has his own purposes with Goebbels. So, you know, he's not reliable at all.
Well, he's good for some things.
Well, yes, David Irving is. But if you're only good for some things, I don't consider that reliable. See,
you have to read him carefully.
Well, you have to know ahead of time what you think is true and false, and then you can judge according to what he says. Yeah, right. I agree. He's got some good. I know that some of those books are very good. But it's always if he's saying the things you like, then you think he's good, and if he's not, then you don't think he's so good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Hattie.
I think that Goebbels' diaries are originally right, because there are so many, many details. I mean, who can construct all those happenings and events in? And as you said, Carol, I mean, David Irving is not always 100% reliable in his books and statements. I mean, I like
well, he says that they're reliable. Yeah, I find that very confusing. He says that the diaries are Goebbels, and then he says that they're not. So I don't know what he's saying there, but are you saying part of it is not whatever? But I have no idea. I find that very confusing. But I don't think that anything that has been claimed that is based on Goebbels' diaries really is very convincing at all. Anyway,
yeah.
It's always kind of vague. Yeah. So you think that the diaries are not? You already said you don't think that they're authentic.
Right. Well, I don't think anything that spent that long a time in Soviet. I don't trust anything that came out of the Soviet Union.
Well, I'm with you there. I pretty much agree with that. Well, let's see. We've got a few more minutes. I think we covered this pretty well. Let's go back to the art. What little we can add. I think that we need to make clear again that here's the thing I would like to end up with, and then you guys can end up with yours. We are so used to our style of freedom and our artistic freedom, what we consider artistic freedom, that we think anything different from that is terrible suppression and so on. And yet, if we just look at what we what's the results of what the art world is like when anything goes, and then we compare that to where you have some guidelines and some ideas about what is okay and what is not. I think the latter is much better. I don't like any more of this ultimate freedom to do anything you want.
Well, this business, Carolyn, of ultimate freedom really isn't freedom. To say you have...
You end up very unfree.
That is not really freedom, and it's not really the hallmark of a true civilization. And let's separate civilizations from, I don't know, certain nations, because great civilizations leave us lasting hallmarks. They leave us art. They leave us sculptures. They leave us architecture. And, the Romans left us that. The Greeks left us that. And no matter how hard, the nabobs of negativism try to go and rewrite history, the Third Reich left us art, music, culture, and architecture and such that speaks for itself. The fact that there is still a concerted effort 70 years later to repress it, to make it illegal to listen to this music, to read these books, to have some of these artworks, that speaks volumes.
And
I encourage you. Yeah.
Well, and they destroyed so much of the sculpture. The public sculpture, just about all of it has been destroyed. 90% of it, and all the buildings were bombed. Let's let Wilhelm have a few. We've got just a couple minutes left. Let's let Wilhelm get in here for some last words. What about what the Third Reich has left us, Wilhelm?
I think first, liberty of an artist can only go that far. If they denounce and present compasses, triangles, as the modern art, that's not accepted. I think what we have seen during the Third Reich period as art for the people is a dramatic example of natural and romantic idealism.
Yes, well, idealism is a quality of the German people, and so it naturally fits with the German people. And what was kind of foisted on the German people in the way of modern art really doesn't fit the German nature. Would you agree with that, both of you? Anybody there?
I agree. I think you're absolutely right, Carol. And I think ultimately what we as a nation also, we need to look at what was done during the Third Reich and understand that pornography is not art. And that's what the National Socialists, did. Under Weimar, pornography became art, and that was rejected by the German populace. It should be rejected by us as well. And all those artisans under Weimar left, and they came over to the United States.
Yes, and we have an awful lot of pornography in art today, and have had for quite a while. We also have a lot of just pure ugliness. Well. Gentlemen, I am so pleased to have had you tonight. Wilhelm Christman and Rodney Martin, thank you so very much. We've come to an end, and we'll do this again. Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.